From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm talking to my guest, Callie Corey, whose newest project, she's creator and executive producer of Nashville on ABC, but she was last here for her film, Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. We, of course, this is the 21st birthday of your Oscar for Thelma and Louise.
It is?
It is.
Oh, my God.
You won in 92, right?
Wow. Yes. Boy, that went fast.
Well, Nashville's going fast, too. And as I was telling you just before we got started, when I saw your name on this, I knew I had to have you on because what's always so much fun about what you do is the way you write people reaching for power. And it's so interesting. We look at all the things you've done, these kinds of shifts, be it Something to Talk About or Yaya Sisterhood or even definitely Nashville, the way people fight for power. And I'm wondering if that's something that you thought about from the very beginning.
I don't think it's anything I do consciously, but I do think that life really is a power struggle. And so it ends up coming into everything I do just a little bit, especially, you know, as you said, 21, 22 years in this business, you know, you do see, like, over the course of many years, you see people who are here to stay. You see people who come in with a bang and then fade away. And so I just always think that that's such an interesting aspect of this business, and the music business is a parallel. And so I thought it would be a great thing to write about, and especially in terms of what's happening in both the film business and the music business right now. We're catching it at a time where everything's shifting. You know, we're in a period of interregnum where we don't know what's the future is going to be. But the old models have died, and everybody's just kind of fighting and elbowing each other to keep their place in it.
But it's also set in this place that is full of its own rules and tradition by being set in Nashville,
right?
Which is a place that likes to pretend it's a lot more traditional than it actually is.
Well, Nashville is a very interesting place because its persona is so much less sophisticated than it actually is. It's an incredibly beautiful, well taken care of, extremely well educated population.
And a lot of money, yeah, around that.
A lot of money and a lot of, you know, I mean, the hospital corporations that are all centered there. I mean, there's 7 universities there. It's a flourishing city. And the music business is kind of like the film business is in L.A. It can give the feeling of it being kind of a company town in one way, but it's really not. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff going on there besides just music. However, the music scene that is going on there is one of the most vital and thriving I've ever seen. And it's been that way for a number of years, no matter what shape the business is in. And because, you know, that's a business, music business, entertainment business in general is always one that's in some stage of flux. But the music scene itself thrives. There are so many brilliant musicians there. The bench is so deep. The level of musicianship that you find in that city is just astonishing. And, you know, when you have that many creative people in one place, something great is bound to happen. And there it does, like all day, every night, you can walk into any club and just hear the greatest music in the world. And the level of songwriting that's taking place there, everything. I mean, it's just it's an incredibly fertile storytelling ground.
But I guess I find myself thinking about, in terms of that power shift, you have these women that are actually kind of going toe-to-toe, and I know you said this in interviews, but I can't help but think that the way Tanya Tucker started, you know, with Raina, played by Connie Britton, she's the kind of woman who would have been made fun of the way she's making fun of Juliet.
Right.
It was played by Hayden Panettiere at this point. So it's a funny way to start the show.
That's always been going on. You know, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I just imagine that Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette were looking at Tanya Tucker going, who does she think she is?
But you think about when Dolly Parton got started.
Right.
She was treated exactly the same way. And you couldn't have been any more traditional than,
right,
Dolly Parton was.
Right.
And so, again, that power is just shifted. So now it's women who have as much power in that country world as men.
Well, you know, I wish that it were more true than it is. Actually, the country music business is incredibly male-dominated still. I mean, when you look at the top of the charts, there's way fewer women than there are men. There are way fewer women who get big number one songs, you can kind of all name them on one hand. But I mean, you know, it's always been that way. I don't know that there's ever been a time where women have dominated in any aspect of the business, of our business, or, you know, it's just there are the few that make it and the thousands that almost make it. And to me, that's again, part of the reason I thought it was such a great idea to set the story there.
It's a great idea, too, because to get these women who, again, you sort of think about how small the success is for women, as you were saying, you think about how women had kind of gone from one archetypal role to another. They kind of went from that old school sort of Tammy Wynette to Dolly Parton to Tanya Tucker to Faith Hill to now Taylor Swift. There's basically been like only one archetype at a time for women.
Right. Well, I mean, there's also Miranda Lambert and people like that who have more of the outlaw edge to them. And then there was Crystal Gayle, who was, you know, had, you know what I mean? It was, there have been all different kinds. But I mean, you know, I look at also the music that was happening in Nashville at the time. And, you know, Emmylou Harris was, I mean, I still worship the sound of her, just the very existence of her. You know, she was doing another kind of thing there. And that scene has real longevity. I mean, the roots music and the more traditional music, I mean, it really is kind of, that's on the most solid path of anything because it's never something that gets so big that it consumes itself or goes out of style, you know? I mean, it's a goes to a very specific group of people and done by a very specific group of people. And now as you watch Avett Brothers and Mumford and Sons, and I mean, you know, I have to credit T-Bone.
Well, say you, yeah, you know, because basically T-Bone Burnett, your husband, is a part of that scene where you're talking about Emmylou Harris when she got started.
And, you know, just even the success of Oh Brother.
The soundtrack.
Which kind of revitalized that and you know.
And actually, more than that, brought to the mainstream the way they had never been before.
Right.
These things that people kind of remarked about or got written about. Maybe when Dolly Parton would duet with Emmylou Harris, then it would get some attention. But
right.
It still kind of lingered as this thing that was vital but outside the mainstream. And Oh Brother brought that roots music. There wouldn't be a Mumford and Sons
right.
without that.
Avett Brothers.
Yes.
I mean, the list goes on.
Civil Wars even.
Civil Wars, exactly. And it's interesting because, I mean, I've actually heard them say that to him, you know, that without that movie, they wouldn't be doing the kind of music that they're doing.
See, I kind of find amazing that voice kind of like lingers in the music of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sort of thing where, you know, you've got pop really on one side and pop on the other side. And there's always been this sort of competitive edge in pop anyway. But then the river that sort of like keeps them separated is that roots music that you're talking about. But you
right.
have Civil Wars and Elvis Costello writing songs for the soundtrack.
Right. I mean, and, you know, that's the thing that makes it really fun because that's an honest representation of what it's like in Nashville. You know, you have such a breadth of music that exists there, that really thrives there. And one of the things that always used to kind of frustrate me was whenever I would see any outside representation of what Nashville was like, I was always shocked by how little it bore any actual resemblance to what it sounds like there. I mean, it's always kind of like the music is way more elegant and way more heartfelt and way more, it's more primal or something in a way. You know, it's meant to move you. It's meant to kind of enter your system and become part of you. And, you know, I can remember performances that I saw 30 years ago that like they were yesterday, just a songwriter with a guitar and a microphone in a small club and just lay it a waste. I mean, just absolutely incredible performances all the time. The rest of the world will never know about them, never know who they are. And yet, you know, in Nashville, there are still these revered people.
But there are also people there, you know, Lamb Chopper based in Nashville.
Right. I mean,
there are all kinds of greats.
Well, Dan Auerbach, the Black Keys live there. The Kings of Leon are there. I mean, Jack White is there.
But you stole him from Detroit. It's the treatment, yes. I guess, is our old friend Callie Curry, who's back. She's the executive producer and creator of the show Nashville on ABC. What I like about the show so much is just sort of seeing how you define the characters very quickly, and we think we know them, and we don't.
That makes me happy to hear you say that.
Really?
Yeah. Because I do, I like to start people out as stereotypes because I think that's what people do. I think they look at people and they size them up very quickly and, You know, my whole one of the things I like to do as a writer is say, oh, not so fast. You think you know them, but you don't. Let's just slowly peel back the layers here and let you see who's really in there.
One of the things that's so much fun about the show, too, is there's such velocity in it. And it's like you sort of set out to say, I'm going to make this work so fast that you almost have to go back and watch an episode again because the turns are so subtle in it. And that's got to take a lot of time to write.
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't take a lot of time to write because we don't have it. And I have, you know, I would love to be able to list all of the writers in the writer's room by name right now because it is the hardest working group of people I've ever met in my life.
It's a hard show to write, though, isn't it?
It is a very difficult show to write. It's, you know, we've got a lot of characters and the turns do have to be big. And yet, you know, we are interested in the details. So we have to be able to make those big turns at the same time show the most, you know, the smallest moments of human emotion and what goes along with wanting, you know, with desire, with wanting to be an artist, with wanting to be seen as an artist, with wanting to, you know, with, I mean, that's really what the show is about, is everybody wanting to make their mark. And they're driven to it, or they're pulled to it, or they're, you know, because I think the people that are in this business, none of them are doing it because they want to. They're doing it because they have to. It's too hard. You have to.
I just find myself thinking so much about this show and that it's really a show about, you were saying artists, but I feel like it's a show about people wanting to be taken seriously on their own.
Right.
Because what you've done, and you set it off in the pilot, is every person who seems to stand on his or her own stands in the shadow of somebody else. It's almost like Russian literature in that way.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think that's unrealistic. You know, I think that everybody is measuring themselves against who came before them and are they going to be as good and are they going to be as big and is their mark going to be as important in the music world? Are they going to have the longevity of some of the artists that we look up to? I mean, listen, I still am, I worship at the feet of, you know, Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash and Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette and George Jones and all those people that I listened to, not when I was growing up. I mean, I guess I was growing up because I was in my early 20s, but that's when I really started getting hip to that music, and it was old then. And to me it was. I mean, of course it wasn't really old, but they were all still alive. But when I started to understand what they were saying and what they were writing about, and where that music came from, it's like at some point when I was in college, I suddenly saw the continuum all the way from the hills of, you know, the Appalachian Mountains and the hills of Tennessee. And, you know, I could hear the folk influence in everything. I could hear the bluegrass and everything. And I just felt like, oh, my God, this happened in 30 minutes. This isn't a, you know, this, you think of it, it's thousands of years old. It's not. It's like 30 minutes old. It's really vital music. And, you know, recently I saw the Punch Brothers, who, you know, again, are just one of the most amazing groups of musicians you can ever hope to see. And we saw them at New Year's Eve, the Bowery Ballroom in New York. And it was a fantastic show. And they did the Brandenburg Concerto. And it was incredible. It was just absolutely incredible. And it was like, you felt like you were getting to see the music as it was meant to be played because it was wild. It was just, it was on fire. It wasn't any of the stuff that you're used to. It wasn't proper at all. It was these guys just up there stomping their way through it. And it was so incredible. And I mean, to see people on their feet, arms above their head, clapping to classical music, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about.
We're going to take a break. My guest is our friend Callie Curry. It's always good to have her back. Her newest project as writer, creator, executive producer is Nashville on ABC. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Welcome back to The Treatment. My guest is Callie Curry. You know her from so many things. Something to talk about as a writer, as a director and writer, Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. Her newest project on ABC is Nashville. I know you'd said in the past that you wanted Connie Britton for this. Did you imagine that you could be able to get Eric Close and Powers Booth for this show? I mean, and Powers Booth basically plays it as if he's like, if he's running the Grand Ole Opry and the city at the same time.
Well, I mean, you know, he is one of the most incredible actors to me. I mean, he just brings such gravitas to everything that he does. And he's one of the nicest people in the world. I mean, he's really, truly a lovely guy. And so how he pulls off playing just this bad, bad man is really amazing because he's a very sensitive artist, you know. He's got a very great ability to play a complicated villain.
The most interesting thing about that guy is he could be, again, a figure in politics, a political figure, or an entertainment world figure.
Right.
I mean, that kind of Machiavellian figure who doesn't really see that anything he does is wrong.
All you have to do is turn on the television. I mean, you know, politics is filled with that. I am astonished constantly that people who will stand up and say the most outrageous, judgmental, harsh things about our fellow citizens, and they think they're saying something wonderful. They think they're giving us all a moral lesson and, you know, we're just too blind to see. And I think he's one of those kind of guys that just feels like, I don't know why everybody else can't see it the way I do. It's plain as the nose on your face. You know, I know what I'm talking about. You don't. And that's kind of where that starts. And I'm fascinated by those people.
Well, you've written that kind of guy a lot, going back to Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise, somebody who basically thinks the world in terms of immediate gain and doesn't really see that anything that he does is wrong.
I guess, you know, it's kind of the puer eternis in certainly in some of the male figures of just feeling like, oh, here is the world to me on a platter, and I am a young man, no matter how old I am. It's all coming to me. It's all flowing my way. And so, you know, they really don't see consequences of their actions, how they affect other people, or it's not even really a consideration because they do have this what's best for me is best for everyone kind of worldview.
And the films you've done in the past have been about these kinds of these friendships that people find, particularly women, they get past the fact that the world is pitting them against each other.
Right.
And they find a way to sort of bridge that. And here, just watching these chasms that exist between these characters, you just, especially with Raina and Juliet, after Scarlet comes to the picture, you want to say, help her.
Yeah.
She needs you. See this somehow. And you're talking about that Nashville of the 60s and 70s where you see Merle and Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, or again, Dolly and Emmy Lou and get together. Those kinds of alliances would be made. But that doesn't happen in Nashville that you're writing.
Well, I mean, they do actually go on tour together, and they do put themselves in a mutually beneficial situation. They have a hit song together. But, I mean, I think that's also something really interesting about writing about the entertainment business is that, you know, there is the show and the face that you show to the world, and then there's reality. And, you know, how much of the real person are you seeing on stage? I mean, for years working in this business, you see actors that are beloved by the world, and behind the scenes, you're just smacking your forehead going, how did they get to be the most popular person in America? You know, and it's always challenging to understand how, you know, I always say one of the most difficult things about being in this business, if I'm asked what's the hardest thing about being in Hollywood, I say to younger people, the thing that's hardest that you have to get used to is that bad guys win and win big every day. Like being good, being a good person, being all of that, it doesn't have anything to do with success because mean, horrible people can be just as successful, if not more, than the best human being in the world. And even talent doesn't come into it that much at some point. You know, it's like, yes, that has to be there, but there's a lot of talented people. But this is a tough business, and you better be ready. And I do feel a bit like I'm sending the lamb to slaughter in the character of Claire Bowen's character, Scarlett. Because, I mean, Scarlett is based on many people that I knew when I lived there, you know, just these people who suddenly realized, oh my God, when I sing, I'm not just singing, it's actually something really special, you know? They grew up singing, they don't even really think about it. And then they start looking around and they're like, wow, I'm pretty good. This is really fun. This feels great, you know? And just starting somebody at that point with no ambition and just watching her get sucked in and watching the seeds of that ambition get planted, I'm having a blast with that.
My guest, who's looking at me a little bit too much as she's saying those awful things about no talent and ambition, is Callie Curry. She's the executive producer and creator of the show Nashville on ABC. It's The Treatment. What's it like, because you worked in the movie business where sometimes you can write something and wait for a while for it to get done. You're now in a position where you, as you were saying, half the time you're behind because you got to fill this thing. And there's a lot of dialogue in this show. It's really dialogue heavy.
There is. Fortunately, I have an unbelievable staff. I mean, our showrunner, Dee Johnson, leads a group of writers that is exquisitely talented and very hardworking. I mean, you know, we all understand this challenge that we're up against because it is a big show. I mean, it is a lot to do every week, and the musical aspect of it makes it even more challenging because we really, really strive to keep the show as realistic on every level as we possibly can. And so, you know, there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of details, and there's a lot of character overlap and interaction.
And it's all shot on location, would you
yes,
say?
Yes, it's all in Nashville. And the writer's room is here, but now we bring the writers out for their episodes, and I come back and forth and try to spend as much time in each place as I can. But without those writers, this wouldn't be happening at all. There's no way I personally could produce that volume of material. Absolutely no way. And so, you know, it is truly a monumental effort by a just incredibly talented group. And I am like forever in their debt, totally grateful. And Dee is a fantastic showrunner, and I've been blessed to have that, you know, because I know a lot of experiences that I know from people over the years. You know, you can have a very contentious writing room, you can have a room with a lot of different opinions. In this room, we don't have time for that. We are very high functioning. Everybody gets along. There's a lot of laughing.
But the really interesting difference is, again, in setting up these sort of things, we have the present and the future, and the future is being corrupted. If you're Lamar and you basically have no sense of anything outside of yourself, versus if you're Raina, who really suffers over everything, because despite the kind of, you know, sort of selfish act she's capable of too, she feels everything a little bit too deeply.
Well, yes, she does. I mean, you know, she went through a trauma as a child. You know, she lost her mother when she was very young. There was a big rift between her and her father. You know, as the season goes on, you'll find out more about why that happened and what actually happened. But, you know, there is a, you know, she is a very lonely person. She really is. You know, Connie and I have talked about this a lot. She's kind of an island. And she's the person, she's had to be there for herself, and she's had to be there.
But she almost doesn't trust anybody because she's been through so much. And she really wants to trust Teddy, even though she pushes him away.
Right, right. But, you know, as you see with Teddy, he's only marginally trustworthy even to himself because he's on a quest. His backstory is something that we haven't really exposed as much in the show as we had originally intended. But, you know, Teddy himself came from a very wealthy family. His grandfather and his great-grandfather
he's Al Gore, basically.
Yeah, but big politicians, except his father. His father was a drunk and a failure. And he spent his early years wild and crazy. He lost his trust fund. He blew through his trust fund. He got it together, ended up having a thriving business in real estate development, and lost it all in the crash. And has also been the man behind the scenes in Raina James's life, you know? So he's been put in this position of absolute powerlessness several times in his life, you know? And so he's got this chip on his shoulder because he wants to be his grandfather and his great-grandfather, and forget about his father, but all the weaknesses of his father are still alive and well in him, and ones that he was almost undone by in his own early youth. And he overcame all that. And a lot of it he overcame because he wanted to be the man that he thought Raina needed. But it doesn't always work out the way you plan it, sorry.
Which gets us back to the way I started the conversation, these things, the relationships about pursuit of power and whether you wield that power in benevolent ways or in malicious ways is something that you do.
It's funny. I never think about it like that. To me, I'm always coming at it from a very, can I emotionally justify this character doing this? Is there any basis in reality for this behavior? You know, it doesn't matter how selfish it is. I mean, listen, there's nothing that I could think of. There's not a single thing I could think of that doesn't exist in reality anyway. It's like, but is it true to these characters? Is it true to the story? Is it important to the story to show this aspect of a character? And I think it really is in a number of ways, because right now, I mean, we're watching our country trying to pull itself out of a similar slump. We're in an interregnum ourselves, you know? I mean, our government has never been more dysfunctional, even though I'm sure every generation argues that their government is completely dysfunctional. But, you know, we do seem like we've reached a new low in the last 12 years. And
I mean, it's funny you're saying that all these alliances that should exist on your show in Nashville,
right,
that won't because of personal pride.
Right.
You could definitely say that there's metaphorical. We can see sort of the connection between that and then the schisms between the Democrats and the Republicans now,
right,
couldn't we?
Right. And it works to no one's benefit, and yet people are steadfast in their beliefs that their way is the right way, and damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, and, you know, where are we going? It's really hard to get people to take the long view if their only interest is themselves. People talk about our future and our children and all that.
That's one of the things about it that kind of makes this show interesting as compared to the other stuff you've done. There's often been a character, be Michael Madsen or Robert Duvall or somebody in the things you've done before who takes the long view. And that doesn't happen with anybody here. You've eliminated that purview from this. Is that to create that kind of conflict that we have here?
I think in some ways. I mean, Waddy White takes the long view, but only because he's been there so long. So
And not for selfless reasons,
yeah,
either.
Yeah. But, I mean, he has a lot of experience. And so I think at least he's a realist.
But there's kind of it's closest to that, but there's often in the things you've done tends to be somebody who functions as a voice of reason.
Right.
You left that out of this, and obviously for a reason, didn't
right.
you?
Nobody listens anyway.
That's the motto of this show.
Yeah.
We're out of time. Kelly, thank you so much for being here. It's always good having you. Thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Kelly Curry. She's the creator and executive producer of the show Nashville on ABC. A recording engineer who also mixes the show's J.C. Swadek is edited and produced by Jenny Radelite. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.